Twice a week, Van Lathan and Rachel Lindsay dissect the biggest topics in Black culture, politics, and sports on their show, Higher Learning. They discuss the most important and timely conversations while also frequently inviting guests on the podcast and occasionally debating each other. Check out Higher Learning on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Trello help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Bakari Salas podcast. Today we'll be interviewing my good friend and Washington Post sports reporter, Kent Babb. We'll talk about college football and his new book, which is so, so dope, Across the River. But before I get to Kent, I've got to talk about this Defund the Police amendment sponsored by Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville that passed 99-0 a couple of days ago. Here's the clip from the floor speech between Tuberville and New Jersey Senator Cory Booker.
I call on my colleagues to support our law enforcement by voting yes for this amendment. Opposing my amendment is a vote in support of defunding the police and against the men and women in blue.
The gentleman's time has expired.
Madam President.
Senator from New Jersey.
I am so excited. This is perhaps the highlight of this long and painful and torturous night. This is a gift. If it wasn't complete abdication of Senate procedures and esteem, I would walk over there and hug my colleague from Alabama. And I will tell you right now, thank God, because there's some people who have said that they're members of this deliberative body that want to defund the police, to my horror. And now this senator has given us the gift that finally, once and for all, we can put to bed this scurrilous accusation that somebody in this great esteemed body would want to defund the police. So let all of us, 100 people, not walk, but sashay down there and vote for this amendment and put to rest the lies. And I am sure I will see no political ads attacking anybody here over defund the police. And I would ask unanimous consent to add something else to this obvious bill. Can we add also that every senator here wants to defund the police, believes in God, country, and apple pie? Thank you.
So I'm sure you're all asking, what's the point on this given that it's a non-binding and largely symbolic amendment? Well, the answer here is simple. Politics and midterm elections. The reality is Booker is excited because the vote gave every Democrat a chance to say that they don't support defunding the police. And while I'm sure many listeners are firmly in the defund and abolish camps, the fact of the matter is that politically defund itself remains deeply unpopular with voters, even if the alternatives to policing that defunding would support are popular with voters. The Republican playbook on winning back the House and the Senate in 2022 is to make voters think that Democrats want to defund the police, that black-on-black crime is killing our cities, and all the brown people are crossing the border. That's the playbook in 2022, and Democrats have to find a way to beat it. We all take issue with the police, and I fight them literally every day for abuses and misconduct. But my hope is that even if you're firmly in the defund or abolition camp, there's still a realization that most Americans aren't in said camps, and we want to see better policing, not no police at all. Those are the politics, and I think we all be better served to focus on the issue at hand, which is police reform, and do the hard persuasion work it'll take to get people to move closer to a reality where they need fewer police. Until then, though, we can't give the Republicans the win at the ballot box supporting a movement that will put people like Tommy Tuberville and Tom Cotton in the majority. And that's that on that. Now on to our show with my friend, Kent Babb. Man, today I have the privilege of interviewing on the Bakari Sellers podcast somebody I go way back with who actually got his start. He actually learned how to write from a young man named John Monk. No, just but he got his start at the state newspaper, or one of his stops along his career. But now he has a great new book out. But what's going on, Kent Babb? How are you, my friend?
I'm doing good, man. Thanks so much for having me on this.
I know you're doing the daily grind of trying to go out and sell this book. How is it in the Zoom world now? Instead of book stops, you're doing Zoom world, isn't it?
Man, it's a little bit different. My first book did not have quite the wide audience as this. That was a biography of Allen Iverson. There, that answered your question. Just like a lot of crazy stuff, microphones on a piece of plywood. Basement dungeon. I'm afraid of the sunlight now, man. I don't like to go outside anymore.
I see it. No, I tell folk all the time, man, that I'm the only person who had a New York Times bestseller doing an entire book tour with no pants on. I just sat in front of my computer and just traveled around the world. But look, this is how our guests are normal. Or they are normalized. They understand how I start each episode because I started the same way. Because one of the things I want people to do is get a chance to know who you are. So walk us through the arc of your career. And you started your career at a newspaper that many of us know well, which is The State. Walk us through the major stops on your career from The State to your beat now at The Washington Post.
I was lucky enough to start covering high school sports, mostly football, right out of the University of South Carolina. And that was a lucky job. Then 3 months into that, I started covering the Steve Spurrier Gamecocks, a team that you may know well. And then the Kansas City Star in 2007 made the foolish decision to have me go and cover the NFL and the Kansas City Chiefs. And this is way before they started winning Super Bowls, way before Patrick Mahomes. I like to joke around that like I learned the art of writing the losing game story because they were terrible in those years. So I wrote a lot of losing game stories, became a columnist for like 5 minutes. And then in 2012, the Washington Post hired me to write features, kind of with an emphasis on the NFL. And my job now has evolved into more like sports and society, culture, some politics, stuff like that. So there are all these intersections that sports touches. And my job is to go find them and write about them.
Man, that sounds like a dream job. I know there are a lot of young people out here listening like, wait a minute, all he does is write about sports. I mean, when you get prepared every day, do you have like one of those encyclopedic memories of sports, or did you grow up reading, you know, how some people say they grew up reading the box scores? Is that kind of how you got your start?
Man, I used to, seriously. Like, back in the day, like when the Atlanta Braves were like winning the division every year, I mean, I knew all this like crazy trivia that like David Justice and Greg Maddux had the same birthday, like born on the same day in 1996. I think it was April 14th, 1966. That may not be true, but it's close. And I used to know it for sure. And I could just remember all this crazy stuff. And I knew like in high school that I wanted to be a sports writer. And I joke now that I used to care way more about the sports than the writing. And now I'm like way more into the writing than the sports. What's funny is like I still love football. Like that's my favorite sport, despite like all of its many, many, many problems. But I like basketball. But like I don't watch sports that much anymore. I mean, it's kind of work.
You're grown. So like.
Yeah, like you, man, I got a little one and like she goes to bed. And by the end, man, I'm just tired. I can't stay up till midnight watching the end of a game. And so my best story, my worst story is a couple years ago, my editor asked me if I wanted to go cover the Super Bowl in Atlanta. And I'm like, yes, as long as I don't have to stay for the game, because like all the fun stuff at the Super Bowl. Yeah, I know everybody makes that face. The fun stuff at the Super Bowl happens before the game. Like I've covered two. I've been at two the whole week, New York and New Orleans. And this, like the Super Bowl game is a game, you know, the halftime show was a big deal, but like the game is a game. And I was just like, let me go down there. Maybe
Miami or New Orleans, I may not make it to the game. Bakari may be passed out in some bar in New Orleans with a press pass on, but I would intend on going to the game.
Yeah. Nobody likes that story except me, but I keep telling it because it amuses me. It's a terrible, terrible, like first world journalism problem, but I think it's very amusing.
No worries. We'll get to your book Across the River shortly, but you did mention this and I can't start there. Your first book chronicled the life of the greatest player ever in the history of basketball under 6 feet tall. His name is Allen Iverson.
What was it about AI that drew you to him, and where does AI rank, in your opinion, all time amongst guards?
Man, that's a great question. I just had a long late night debate with my friend and colleague Jerry Brewer at the Post about like whether Allen Iverson is the best guard of all time. And I think I said he was not, because like I don't know if he works today, you know, like I don't know if I think there's a lot of Allen Iversons out there, but like in 96, 97, 98, there were none. Like there are no like slash through the lane, go to the basket, I'm not scared of you, Shaq. Come get me, Kobe. The thing that I loved about him, and I was a fan of AI before I was a biographer of AI, is that he was fearless and he was not going to change. Like one of my favorite anecdotes in the whole book is Larry Brown went up to AI at one point and was like, look, man, you can't keep wearing these clothes. Like you can't be wearing like your jeans and a jersey, like that not becoming of an NBA superstar. So he went out and bought a suit because Michael Jordan wore these awesome suits and wore it to the game one time, wore it to the arena one time. His friends clowned him. It was just like, man, this is not you. So Larry Brown walks in the locker room after the game and found that suit balled up. This is like a $3,000 suit, man. Found that suit balled up like under his locker and he never wore it again ever. And I mean, but I think that's cool, you know, because he knew who he was. He stopped knowing who he was for like a minute. And then he became like this great anti-hero that like David Stern hated, that white people kind of hated. They just didn't, like, people didn't know what to make of AI and his cornrows and his tattoos and the way he spoke. But, like, man, like, why I think he worked is because, like, remember, like, that's the same time that we fell in love with, like, Stone Cold Steve Austin and Tony Soprano. Oh, yeah. Like, we loved, like, you know, kind of, like, this anti-hero that, like, was a little bit raw, you know, but like we could still pull for him. So, man, I loved that guy. I was pulling for him in 01 against the Lakers. That was just like too strong of a team.
Yeah, it's no, rough. That was one of the best. That was one. The Lakers went 16-1 in a playoff that year. That was yeah. rough. But he
and that one game was to the Sixers.
exactly. And he played his ass. It's funny because in that story, in the AI story, there's one hero. Well, there are a few heroes, but there's one major hero, and that's John Thompson. Because here you had this guy who almost lost. He almost was going to jail forever. I mean, it was bullshit, but still almost going to jail forever. And here he is. He ends up at Georgetown. I mean, that's just amazing. You also cover the college football beat. So what should we expect from our Gamecocks this year? And what's the ceiling for Shane Beamer?
Man, I think this year, Payne. I'm going down for the first game, or at least I'm planning to go down for the first game. We'll see what Delta has to say about that. But
who do we play in that game?
It's like it's Eastern Illinois, which like I think will be a win. I think
we should
be
beat
a rough
Eastern
one.
Illinois. Yeah, Eastern Illinois. And then we go. The game that I find to be a dangerous game is we go to Greenville, North Carolina, to play ECU in Greenville. I'm like, what athletic director signed up for this? Like, who does that?
Oh, man. We don't want to talk about no Ray Tanner on this, do we?
No, we don't. Please.
Yeah, that's like inside Gamecocks craziness. No, like, I don't know. I think Beamer can recruit. I think if they can pull one win out that they shouldn't this year or keep it close against like a Georgia or Florida, I'll be happy. I like Shane Beamer because I hated Will Muschamp. I'm supposed to be impartial. I'm not supposed to care. I cared. I cared way too much.
Let me just tell you this. I did not want Shane Beamer. I hated Will Muschamp. I cared a lot. Will Muschamp knows that I disliked him. And I think that Ray Tanner is an awesome baseball coach and doesn't need to be anywhere near the administration for anybody's school. So that's my wholehearted opinion on it all. So one more question, because I got to ask you this because you know so much about this. But what about Oklahoma and Texas joining the SEC? Tell me what your thoughts are about that, because I love the fact that Oklahoma is joining the SEC. I think it's going to be uber competitive. And Texas, I mean, they're barely as good as Texas Tech, so I don't even care about that.
Yeah, I mean, like in college football in particular, I like chaos. I like messes, you know? And I mean, Texas is getting tired of going, they're tired of losing to Big 12 teams, so they're going to go lose to some SEC teams. And so I don't really think it helps them. I mean, they're going to go lose to Alabama and Florida every year now. And so I don't know. I like it because people hate it, I think. And it doesn't matter. I don't want Clemson in the SEC. I could live without that. But also, like, I kind of want Clemson to like play a real schedule every year, and like, so that part is appealing. But as far as the two teams that are going to be joining, I don't know. Like, it doesn't make any difference. I am a 16-team playoff guy, and I want everybody in, man. I want everybody to have a shot. I want it to be messy.
You woke up this morning and chose violence and chaos. Okay.
Yes. I'm the Joker. Yeah. Like, I love that stuff, man.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details. This episode is brought to you by Cars.com. When you add your car to your garage on Cars.com, you'll unlock access to real-time insights into how much your car is worth. Plus, view its historical and projected value to decide when to sell. So when the time is right, you can secure an instant offer from a local dealership or sell it yourself on Cars.com. Start tracking your car's value with your garage on Cars.com. This episode is brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. As a ruthless king builds his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape will fight for the future of apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX this Friday and in theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.
All right, let's talk about your newest book, Across the River. What's it about and why did you write this book?
So a couple years ago, 2018, I wrote an article about somebody who was being very honest about gun violence in his city. So New Orleans is a place where, you know, we talk about gun violence in this country, we tend to talk about the South Side of Chicago. That's not just misguided. It's also kind of an insult to people of New Orleans. Like, they want to be the best at this terrible thing. And it's actually worse in New Orleans because, like, shots get fired at any time of day in any neighborhood. Just the other night. On Saturday night, the first hours of August, 5 people got shot on Bourbon Street. So, I mean, this happens. It doesn't happen a lot, but it happens. Like, the murder rate in New Orleans is actually worse than like Chicago, St. Louis, Baltimore, and it's a way smaller country. I went down and covered Will Smith's, the former Saints player, his having been gunned down. And I was just like, man, there's way more
to
the story.
Didn't that trial end up with the guy being, they just remanded it, didn't they? And he was let out on bond.
Yeah, so like I think he's probably going to be retried. He initially got convicted of manslaughter. I haven't read like a ton into Cordell Hayes's latest what's happened with him, but there was a fender bender after dinner. They argued, guns got drawn. Will Smith got killed and his wife got shot. And it's just like, I mean, that's just like sort of how you settle stuff, you know, in New Orleans.
Those are two big boys. Those boys were big boys. But why did you choose Algiers? I feel like this could have been in a lot of places, but what was it about the Algiers community that drew you in?
It's so close to the New Orleans that so many of us know. Like, people like me do not go to places like Algiers. Like, we stay on the French Quarter where it's quote unquote safe. That's where all the bars are. That's where all the voodoo tours and things like that are. The first time I got into an Uber and asked him to take me to Algiers, the driver asked me if I had the wrong address in there. And because, like, you know, a white guy just does not often cross the bridge. And, you know, I mean, it is a very different part of this city than I was used to going in. I'd never been over there. And within 30 minutes of me being at the school, these people are showing like how honest and authentic they are, like even with a reporter present. There's a young senior running back telling me the first time he broke into a house. There's a top assistant coach saying, like, man, I used to sell pills and weed. Football saved me. And like, you hear a lot of this, you know, and I explore stuff like, you know, are sports something that really like solve these problems or bring us together? Or is it something like, particularly like in the Trump and post-Trump era that we just say? Does that make us feel better somehow? And for the first time, I found, you know, a coach and a program, they didn't really care what I thought. They're just like, this is how it is. You know, they're going to show them the real. That's the saying down there. They don't BS. They don't lie. Being inauthentic is the greatest sin. So they show them the real every day and like show them like how to survive, how to get out, how to succeed. And not only that, but like, you're worthy of success. Oh, you know, wow. Like, you can do this. And, you know, like, this is through football. Yes, but it's not about football.
No, I mean, when I read your book, that was one of the first things that I thought you had. When you sent it to me, when you say, could you send it to me? I thought you were sending me a football book. And that's one of the most nuanced things. And I, you know, the cover, you see a football player, but it's more context than that. And I can see this being a movie. Have they started talking about that yet?
There might've been some talk.
Yeah. Don't ruin it on this show of all shows. So what do you want readers to take away from this? I mean, I took that this was like what The Blind Side like should have been. Like, this is like the antithesis to it. Like, The Blind Side was the, as Clorox, Manila version of what it's like not having a way out. And this was like, all right, this is what's happening. This is real life.
Yeah. I mean, I think if people like really want to know how hard it is, you know, for people of color in certain neighborhoods in this country, you know, read this book. I mean, like, you know, white people, you know, and people like me, look, man, I'll just be the first to admit, like, for a long time, I was content to pretend that like, it's just not that bad. You know, it can't be as bad as like what the news media says, even in the news media, you know? So like, it's just easy to pretend that, you know, this is far away. This is like a different world. But it's not. I mean, like, it's comforting to people who look like me to say like, oh, if you pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you can make it to college. If you work hard enough, you can get a good job. That's just not true for a lot of people in this country, Bakari. And like, you know, the protagonist in this book, a young guy named Joe Thomas, he knows he wants to get to college, but he doesn't even know what college is. Like, it's something he's seen in movies.
That was the crazy.
He doesn't know how to do anything.
It was crazy because every time I read Joe Thomas, thought about his character. You know, I just juxtaposed him against Joe Thomas, who's like 6'7", you know, white boy, but who's like everybody's everything in football. And I was just like, these are two totally different people with two totally different trajectories, both trying to get to the same place.
Yeah. And Joe, my Joe Thomas doesn't even know the place he's trying to get to. Yeah. Like he got raised by a single mom who was in the drug trade. She's in prison when the book starts. You know, Joe is on the verge of being homeless. He's got an eviction notice posted to his door. So what do you do? And I mean, the point of this is we all in some form or fashion deal with adversity. We do. And people here, you know, a lot of these folks have never even met a person of a different race. You know, like I was one of the first white people that some of the players had ever met. And I think that was sort of part of Bryce Brown's social experiment and reason for participating in this book. Because everything for him is about embrace the discomfort, learn how to deal with it. You know, you're going to deal with that adversity, but how do you respond? Whether during a traffic stop or whether there's an argument, like how do you de-escalate? It's like learning how to identify and beat the blitz. Like you've got to figure out how to step out of the way, you know, de-escalate, calm the situation instead of what happened with Will Smith and Cardell Hayes. Like a fender bender is not a reason to pull out a gun. And there are different ways. And so that's what this program is about. And if I think if people are interested in football, even if they're not, if you're interested in people, you know, like I don't think this is a poverty story. I don't think it's a black story. I think it's an American story. Like this is an important part, you know, of our country, of our culture that is for too long we've been pretending is not as difficult. It's not real. Well, it is real. And I just want people to sort of, I want to show them this world. You know, I want to show it to him just like I saw it and felt it.
And that's impressive and powerful. How much of this writing or how much did writing this book change you and how you perceive the athletes that you cover? You know, I mean, when you now go back to the newsroom, I mean, we talk about diversity a lot, but you now have this new diversity of thought, which is it was powerful in itself. So how does it change you as well?
It just makes me look at it from a very different perspective because like, though I can't truly like live like the people at Carr live. You know, I spent a lot of time there. You know, I saw and existed and breathed and absorbed as much as I possibly could, which, you know, it, like I tried to get as close as I can, you know, to living like some of the people who live down there. And, you know, when I go back to the newsroom, when I go back into, you know, society or like, you know, kind of, you know, the real world, as it were, like after the book is done, it just makes me know that like, the people who got to the Washington Post, got to the state, you know, got to wherever, man, like what was their journey? Like how hard did they really have it? I mean, everyone, you know, a lot of times, man, it's just like a little miracle that happened. And like, we don't always ask, you know, how did this happen? You know, who helped you? You know, what was like kind of the moment? Like when I was sending the book out for a lot of people, you know, I was just, you know, I was asking like, hey, who was the first person who told you that you could do this? You know, like you don't even know what this thing is. You don't know. It's not just like what your why is. It's what your what is. What is it you want to do? Like, and then how do you get to that? You know, who drew that map for you for the first time? And I was lucky because my mom did that when I was a kid. Like, she thought nothing was impossible. But a lot of people, it's just not that simple. So for the people that I work alongside, that I socialize with, you know, who, like, a lot of people are guarded about their backstory, and you don't probe, you don't pry. But I can still be curious, and I can still appreciate, I can still, like, understand that it wasn't that easy.
That intellectual curiosity is what we're lacking. I mean, this book, because when you honestly, this is kind of crazy, because I know you, I know the book, you read the front and back, but you're just not sure what type of writing you're going to get when you get, and when you open your book, I think this book should be taught in many sports psychology classes across the country, and kind of sports journalism classes as well, because this is not your tried and true journalism, but this, I believe, is where journalism is going today. So with that, I got one more question for you, Kent, before I let you get out of here, because I know you got many other things that you need to do. Talk about Coach Brown, because I feel like in so many Black communities, particularly in the Deep South, you have these football coaches who are not only football coaches, but life coaches and fathers and the unsung heroes of the communities. How important is Coach Brown to Across the River and the Algiers community? And why was it so important that he play a central role in this book?
He's got, like a lot of coaches, he's got all these sayings. You know, one of the best ones is you've got to reach them before you teach them. So he speaks like coarsely, like he speaks the language of young people. Yes, that includes profanity. Sometimes it includes insult. It's real. I mean, like, this book is uncomfortable at times. And I think it should be, you know, like, cause I think understanding, you know, comes sometimes at the cost of comfort. And if you can set that aside, like, you will have a better chance of understanding. But, you know, one of the things that is simultaneously inspiring and haunting about Bryce Brown is another saying, and that's, you have to give a life to save a life. Well, Bryce is truly willing to give his own life. He has no children, no family of his own. He's 400 pounds. Like, he has, you know, a lot of mental health issues that he does not confront. He suffers from imposter syndrome, stress eating. You know, there are a lot of issues that he does not deal with because he has bigger problems. His former quarterback was murdered in 2016, and that changed him forever. This is somebody whose father, whose best friend and favorite player that he's ever coached were all murdered. They're all buried in the same graveyard on the West Bank of New Orleans, and he drives by that graveyard every single day, almost as a form of self-punishment, because he doesn't understand why he made it, why he's still alive, and they're not. So the only way he knows to pay it forward is to teach these young people, this is 100% Black football team, 100% Black coaching staff, teach them the way, you know, show them what he's learned. He's amazingly smart. I mean, like, I've worked for great people managers, inspiring leaders. Bryce is probably the best that I've ever been around, no matter the context, no matter the business. You know, football is easy to him, and it's not about that. It's about reprogramming these vulnerable young people and teaching them that there is a way, like, they can cross the river for good and never come back. And for them, that means success. It's unfortunate. Like, I don't think anybody should have to give a life to save a life. And it sucks in this country that sometimes that's possible. But I'm also thankful that Bryce Brown exists, because there are a lot of Joe Thomases out there and not that many Bryce Browns.
Man, tell folk where they can get the book from, because I will tell everybody you need to get this book before it is a movie or a docuseries or whatever it's going to be. And Kent is an amazing writer. Watching you, you were a great writer then who got on the nerves of some Gamecock fans or Gamecock coaches more so than fans. And you've actually become a much better writer today. So we'll tell folk where they can get the book from.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, man. So goacrosstheriver.com. It's available anywhere. You know, I encourage people to support the local booksellers. You know, like, let's prop these small businesses up, particularly Black owned small businesses like Baldwin and Company in New Orleans. There's Politics and Prose in DC. You know, like, support these places. Please buy this book. Please open your mind to read about this community that we don't like to think about so often.
Man, thank you, my brother, for coming on the Bakari Sellers podcast. Always a true pleasure to be with you. See you in person at the first game when we beat Eastern Illinois. We start off number one, and we're going to get some votes for the top 25.
Go fight, win, baby. I love
All
it.
All right, brother. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Before I let you go, I've got to give a shout out to my good friend and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer for two big wins this week. first and getting the $1 trillion infrastructure package out of the Senate, as well as the budget instructions for Congress to draft a $3.5 trillion proposal to invest in our human and social infrastructure. That's probably the largest single investment in our physical infrastructure and in our housing, schools, and families, and healthcare that we've seen in the history of this country. And $4.5 trillion flowing into the economy should allow us to make massive and transformative investments across the country. Now it's up to the House to get these proposals back to the Senate for final approval and onto the president's desk, a step I imagine will happen before the end of this year. That's a big deal, and he deserves his flowers for helping to deliver the key cornerstones of President Biden's agenda. And it should free up 2022 for Democrats to at least try to deliver on these justice issues I talk about every week, in debt relief from student loans, police reform, and voting rights. That if we can get anything done on this front next year, we can actually run on getting shit done in 2022 and earn folks' votes. And that's that on that. We'll see you all on Monday.